So the study that we're going to do today is continuing to look at the background of the Gospels. And so we have, we're going to talk about the political and religious background of the Gospels. So this will be a little bit less scripture intensive and should just be, hopefully you'll find it interesting. And I wish to credit Mr. Scott Ashley for his efforts in putting this together and being willing to share it, and then I could share it with you. And the reason we're looking at the political and religious background of the Gospels is that it's important to understand this material because it helps us to understand the what Christ went through and what Christ's experience was, and so we'll try to understand exactly what things were like in his time, because it helps us to understand what unfolds in the Gospels and the events that took place there. So we'll begin with the political background of the Gospels. We'll begin with the political world that we find in Judea and Galilee, and the larger Roman Empire, which was part of the world at that particular time. And let's move on to a scripture that's important to this. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. There it says, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." So this verse tells us that there came a point in time, the fullness of time had come, and in the fullness of time, God sent his Son into the world. And what that full idea of fullness is that you have a glass and it's being filled up, and eventually the glass got to the point where it was full, and it was the time for God to send his Son into the world. And so his Son, who had been promised from the time of the sin of Adam and Eve, he was promised to come, and he came forth and was born of a woman and born under the law. So he that has significance, what he lived under during his lifetime, and then it's changed significantly from that point. And he came to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. So again, we see a reference there to family. So the fullness of time is telling us that at just the right time, God sent his Son to the earth. And all of the things that were promised were fulfilled in his first coming. Now, I would say that as you look at that, the fullness of time was associated with the first coming of Christ. I would say the second coming of Christ will also be in the fullness of time. It will be the perfect time as far as what God is working out for Christ to return the second time. So we want to look at another angle here. We realize that the chief entity, the chief governmental entity in the time of Christ was the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was a significant empire because its existence and the way it functioned contributed to the preaching of the gospel and for the gospel going out into the world. Consider, for example, what the conditions would have been like had Jesus not been born at the time he was. He considered that 100, what would have happened 100 years earlier or 100 years later. Had Jesus begun his ministry 100 years earlier, we find that Judea, it was in great turmoil because Rome was trying to consolidate its hold over Asia Minor and the Eastern Mediterranean region. So there was a great deal of turmoil, and it would have been very difficult for the gospel to have been preached. Had he begun his ministry 100 years later than it began, what did we find in Judea? So let's say Christ was born. He died in 31 AD, and then the gospel began to go forth into the world. What would have happened if he had been born in 131 AD? What was going on at that time in Judea? Anybody remember? It's about 136, you had the Bar Kokhba revolt against Rome. They rose up against Rome. They had rose up against Rome in 70 AD. And by about 130, there was a turmoil once again in Judea. And they were rising up against the Romans. And so that rebellion was put down. And they changed the name of Jerusalem to Aelia Capitolina. And no Jews could come into the city of Jerusalem at all. So they said enough of the Jews and all of the upheaval that comes with them. So it would have been very difficult to preach the gospel at that point. It would have been impossible for an organized church to begin and for the gospel to be effectively spread under those conditions. But it came about at just the right time in what we would call the fullness of time. So one of the conditions that existed at the time that the gospel began to go forth, a condition that existed in the Roman Empire, was called the Pax Romana. Does anybody know what Pax Romana means? The peace of Rome. And so Rome was at peace. So Pax Romana refers to the Roman Empire basically enforcing a level of peace and security and stability that hadn't existed before. It was the ideal time for God's church to rise and to go forth preaching the gospel to the world. To understand the alternative, you might think of what's happening in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Can you preach the gospel in those regions today? I would say you would be hard-pressed to do that. So it's not an ideal time to preach the gospel. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's very hard for the gospel to go into those areas today. Without a strong central government to maintain peace and order, it's very hard. It's very hard for things to go forward. It basically becomes a dog-eat-dog world, every man for himself type of a situation. And that's the way it is in the Middle East today. And so you need, when you had dictators like Saddam Hussein, was that the ideal? No, but he did enforce peace. And when I say enforce peace, I mean it literally. You know, if you step out of line, we'll kill you. We'll wipe out your town. We'll wipe out your village. So people lived in fear of that. They took him at his word. And once he died, then that restriction, that bound was gone. And everybody said, well, we'll gain power and take charge. But the Romans were in charge, and they maintained peace and stability through force. So there was the peace of Rome. There was a blessing upon the church. And who enforced the peace of Rome? We had people called Roman soldiers. The Roman legions were throughout the empire, and they were the soldiers that were given the responsibility for maintaining the peace and stability, and they did a brutal but effective job of maintaining the peace. So, as you think about the world in which the Roman Empire ruled and these soldiers ruled, throughout the Gospels, one of the things that you see there is references to robbers and thieves. You just have to look at the Good Samaritan story where an individual had been attacked on the road. That's not just a story that Christ made up. It was the way things were. You could be attacked and robbed and left on the side of the road, and it was a very common thing. And so when the Romans began to rule, they put down a lot of the bands of thieves and all of those kinds of things that were going on. So the Roman soldiers came on the scene, and they greatly contributed to peace in the empire. As you think about Christ, Christ was crucified between two robbers. And Paul mentioned that one of the perils that he faced in his travels was robbers. So it was a fairly common thing in that world at the time. And these things indicate how bad things were when Judea was an occupied territory. Imagine what it was like before the Romans came on the scene and basically enforced peace and sought to eliminate the robbers. So the Pax Romana created a window of time during which the gospel could be spread and the early church could be established. And sometimes we don't realize the events that took place and allowed for God's church to develop and for God's truth to be preached throughout the world. So even though robbers were a problem, the Roman soldiers were able to keep it down to a dull roar, I guess you could say. But that wasn't the only factor in which Rome played an important part in the world at that time. One of the most important factors here, you see this road is in Italy. It's an interstate highway, and you could travel through Rome at a fast clip. Now, this is not a Roman road, but it's just an illustration. We are used to, in our country, having interstates, and we can travel from one place to another at a good clip. And the interstate highways are a great blessing living in our time. If we want to go to San Antonio and enjoy the river walk, we can drive over in a day, can't we, and drive back? You may be pushing it, but you can do it. And you have good highways in order to allow that to happen. And the Romans didn't build, and just like in the United States, does anybody remember why the interstate highways were built? For the military. So that they could move military units from one place to another with ease, with swiftness. And the same thing was true for the Romans. They had issues that would come up, and they needed to get troops to a place in a short amount of time, so they built good roads. And you can still find Roman roads as you travel around the remnants of the Roman Empire. For instance, you see this road here, which I believe is Ephesus and a Roman territory, and so they had roads. Now, we look at these and we think, man, who would want to ride on that? But actually, as you know, there's been a lot of time, erosion, and upheaval. So they didn't build them like this, but time and upheaval does have an impact on it. And the road system allowed people to travel relatively safely and quickly throughout the empire. Paul used the roads, and as did all of the apostles. And this is Ephesus, but if you happen to go to Pompeii, when we went to Italy to the feast a few years ago, you know, the roads look like this, and you can see here, you see ruts that, you would have chariots that would travel down through there, and they were enough of them, and they traveled with enough regularity that you developed ruts where the chariot wheels rode. You have a picture of another wall. Now, for us, that doesn't look very wide, but for chariots and horses and all of that in the time, it was wide enough to get the job done. And so the roads were a wonderful blessing and benefit, and those roads did not exist before Rome. You didn't have the time and the effort and the development of the roads. They developed a technique for building a road. You know, right now, when we build roads, we have a certain way that it's laid down with the different, you know, it's built in kind of layers, and you have certain layers and certain things that are done in order for that road to allow people to travel at 80 and 90 and 100 miles an hour. So that all developed over time. So the Romans were quite good at engineering things like that. Not only were the roads available for the church, but you also have shipping that was available at that time. Shipping had developed and allowed people to travel with ease around the empire. We have, and not only was the shipping available, but what had happened is people were afraid to travel by ship because you had pirates. Pirates were quite prolific at a certain point in time, and the Romans said, enough of this. Now, why did they eliminate the pirates? Because the Romans were all about trade. And you know what? You're attacking our ships. We're unhappy with that. We're taking, you guys are going to cease and desist. So they stopped all the attacking of the trade and ensured that trade would go on, and which would increase their taxes. And as a result of their efforts, it allowed Paul and others to travel. And we know Paul traveled a number of different times by ship. When he was going to go to Rome to go before the emperor, once he appealed to the Roman emperor, he traveled by ship. And he traveled at a bad time by ship. It was not a good season for him to get on a ship and head off toward Rome. But when he told them, let's pull into port here, they were bound and determined to keep going. It all worked out, but he was a little worried about it. Another thing that was available in the time of the empire was the mail system. Now, we don't know a lot of details about the mail system, but it was a system that allowed communication, messages, the letters of the apostles, those epistles to be written and to be shared with other congregations. You had a system that existed that allowed it to go from one place to another, so the gospel was able to be preached. And as a result of them sending out these letters and sharing these truths, then we have what we know as the Bible today, which came from it. Another factor that was important to the spreading of the gospel and the development of the church was the Greek language. The Greek language was the common language at that time. What is the common language in the 21st century? It's English. It used to be French up to a certain point, and then the English became dominant, and English is, if you look at the technical word for the common language, or is lingua franca, which is a French language. That was the language that the French had spread in their trade and in their explorations, and it was a common language. Then the English took over and became predominant, and English became the lingua franca. So you had a lot of languages at the time, but Greek was a common language. So you could travel almost anywhere in the empire, and they may have a native language in that particular area, but most people could speak Latin at the time or Greek, and they could communicate. So you could go there and they're speaking their language. Well, I don't speak that language. And you could speak Greek and most people could understand you. And so the Greek language was important to the spreading of the gospel. That way you could come with God's truth and you could speak Greek, and your audience would understand you. And you didn't have to rely on learning every language on earth. And that the fact that you had the Greek that was so widespread, that's the result of Alexander the Great conquering the known world at the time and promoting Greek culture and Greek language. And it served its purpose for the church. And even though Latin was the language of the Romans, the Romans found it more effective to use Greek. Most of them could speak Greek, and therefore you could communicate anywhere throughout the universe. Yeah, and as you think about that, that's why the New Testament was written and preserved in Greek. It was the commonly understood language of the time. And Greek was also a language that was very appropriate and useful to expressing theological ideas. You may wonder, well, why did the Greeks pursue this idea of the Trinity, which is very involved with Greek, is an outcome of Greek philosophy, human nature and human thinking, but the Greeks were the ones who pioneered that area. And so language, the Greek language is very conducive to speaking about theological things, about biblical things. Had there not been a universal language in use throughout the empire, it would have been a much more difficult task to spread the gospel. So they were able to spread the gospel. So Paul could go into any community. He could go into Galatia or any of the cities that he visited, and he could communicate with them by speaking Greek. And so the Roman Empire really created a stability that had not existed before. And this is the fullness of time. Everything came together to allow for the gospel to be preached, for churches to be raised up, for the apostles to travel throughout the world sharing that message. And there was a window of opportunity for that to occur, and it couldn't have occurred before, it couldn't have occurred after. So it was the perfect time for all of this to take place. Another thing that was common at the time, this is a statue of a god. So does anybody know which god this is? What nation was this god a part of? What is it? It's a dog. What's that? No, it's actually Nubus. But what nation was Nubus a god of? Egypt, right. So this is a Egyptian god, but is this Egyptian clothing? So what you have here is an Egyptian god with Roman clothing, a very nice toga. And so it tells us that the Romans were happy with Nubus. They didn't have any problem with Nubus. But let's dress him up in Roman attire. It will give Nubus a Roman slant. So they were very tolerant of other religions as long as it was in harmony with their empire and you didn't cause any trouble. So they were religiously tolerant in the time of Christ. And so they were tolerant of the various religions of the world, including Judaism and Christianity. So they were tolerant of those things. And that tolerance allowed for God's truth to spread throughout the world. So there were conditions that existed at that time that allowed the gospel to go forward. Now that changed. Now, and one of the things was new religions were not allowed in the Roman Empire. But wasn't Christianity a new religion? Wasn't it new? So why did they allow it? Why did the Romans allow Christianity to be spread and promoted? Bob? Right. Judaism was already accepted. Judaism was already found throughout in different parts of the empire. So this is just a sect of the Jews. So we allow it. Now, eventually they found out, I don't think this is a sect of the Jews. And that's when the persecution set in. But things had gotten off to gone down far enough to where they couldn't stamp out Christianity, and but they didn't realize what was unfolding. So these are a few factors that contributed to the gospel of the kingdom of heaven being spread to the entire world. Now this fellow's name, he's the first of the Roman emperors. You had a Roman government before he took office, but Augustus was the first of the Roman emperors. The empire had been ruled by the Senate since, for the most part, during its founding. And as you're getting closer to the time of Christ, you have conflict and individuals who want to be in power. That's where Julius Caesar and Mark Antony and these individuals who come on the scene that are vying for power. And eventually you have Augustus or Octavius or Octavian. He becomes the emperor. He was the great nephew of Julius Caesar. So Augustus was the emperor from 27, which is before Christ was born, up until 14 AD. So he ruled part of the time that Christ was growing up. He was born and growing up. And it was Caesar Augustus who called for the census or the registration that we read about in Luke chapter 2, where we have them coming up to Bethlehem, returning to Bethlehem, and the census being taken. And that's why Joseph and Mary were commanded to go down to Bethlehem, because of the what the Augustus said, we're going to take a census. There were different ideas about how Rome should be ruled, but under Augustus, the power of the imperial state was thoroughly established. And he is considered to be the first of the Roman emperors, as I said. He assumed power over the empire, and basically the Senate existed, but he was the power behind the throne. And Augustus was a pretty good ruler. Not all the Roman emperors who followed were good rulers at all. And one of the things that he did that affected this part of the world was an idea he picked up from Alexander the Great, who had applied this several centuries before. When you get to the epistles of Paul, you read that the epistles were written to certain cities like Philippi, Ephesus, Colossae, and so on. And what he learned from Alexander the Great was that to establish cities and to have stability in the empire, it was a good idea to have soldiers begin to dwell in that city. Establish cities with soldiers as the foundational element. So they were given land, they were given certain rights, and they provided the stability and allowed for cities to be established, people to move into them, and commerce to take place. So when Paul wrote certain of his letters to the Christians in some areas, a number of these started out as colonies that were led by former military men. So they thought about how are we going to expand the empire, how are we going to create stability, and establishing these colonies with former soldiers was a way to establish that. So you can appreciate, this is, I believe it is the chief, that's where the Senate met in Rome, and you've got the other buildings around there, and you can still see remnants of it when you go to Rome and Capitoline Hill and that kind of thing. So we can appreciate the fact of this influence on the brethren in areas where this happened. It was a way of establishing Roman culture and values throughout the Roman world. That's what Alexander sought to do, and that's what Octavian or Augustus sought to do as well. There are some of the reasons why Greek and Roman culture and influence were so strong in this part of the world, although the underlying culture was Jewish or pagan. It was very tempting for people that were Jewish to go along with it. It was the power that existed. And we see a world that is very powerful, very influential, and it's easy for us to adopt its ways and to become a part of it. We're no different. The next emperor that followed Augustus was Tiberius, and he ruled from 14 AD to 37 AD. So he ruled from when Christ was a boy on through past the time in which Christ died. He was the second of the Caesars, he was the stepson and adopted son of Augustus, and was 56 years old when he began to rule. And he was an older man during his reign and during the time of Jesus' ministry. So these two rulers are individuals who are mentioned in the Gospels as rulers of the time. Another significant ruler of the time was a man named Herod. Herod, he wasn't a Roman emperor, but he was the ruler in Judea. He was the ruler in Judea. The group that was aligned with him, they were called the Herodians. The Herodians, Herod had a family, and the family of Herod was very influential in Judea for a long time. Can anybody think of a significant structure that was built by Herod the Great? Anybody? The temple. Herod, the temple was already established, but he restored the temple and upgraded the temple. One of the things about Herod was that he was a great builder, he had some significant accomplishments in building structures throughout the land of Judea, and he rebuilt the temple and made it a truly magnificent structure. It was not the magnificent structure that it had been during the time of Solomon. It had been rebuilt, but in a much lesser scale. So he made it big. So you might think of him as the Donald Trump of the time. Okay, we got two Herod the Greats in there. So Herod built the temple, and he was 22 years of age when he began to rule, and he gained power and had made friends with the Romans, and the Romans allowed him to rule. Now, was Herod a Jew? He was not. He was an Idumean. He is an Edomite. He was an Edomite. But he was a pretty savvy individual and aligned himself with, he could see the lay of the land. The Romans are going to win this, so I'm going to align myself with them. And he did, and he backed the Romans, and the Romans backed him. When the wise men came to Jerusalem and told Herod that a new king of the Jews had been born, Herod was emphatically not pleased to hear that. So he sought to get the wise men to come back because he wanted to, okay, let's find out where the king is and we'll kill him. So he wasn't interested in worshiping the king. He was interested in killing the king and preserving his power. With Herod the Great, there was a lot of intrigue going on behind the scenes. And if you have a copy of Josephus, you know, it gives you some details about the things that were going on. It was quite a story. The Jews did not like or respect Herod, but they really didn't have the power to unseat him. And one of the things that they hated about Herod was what he did to the high priesthood. The high priesthood had already been corrupted, and he continued that process. The high priest was to be a descendant of what man? A descendant of Aaron. So it was a descendant of Aaron and his family that was to serve in the high priesthood. That had been compromised earlier where they began making political appointments, and it became a political office rather than an office that was not tied in with the powers that be. So what's the problem with a ruler appointing his own priest? Is there any problem with that? What's that? He supplants God, but to whom do you owe allegiance? To God or the person who appointed you? So guess what? When Herod says jump, what are you going to do? You're going to do what Herod says. And that's what they began to do. They were beholding to the Romans, and the Romans appointed a high priest after Herod's time, and the whole situation became compromised. It's the situation we find when Christ comes, and the difficulties he had with the high priesthood. So he appointed the high priest, and the whole thing became compromised, and they were answerable to Herod. No longer were they independent of political powers. It became a political office. And you can see that unfold in the way Christ dealt with the high priest and the priests as a whole. So one of the things that I'm going to do as we get close to the Passover is talk about some things that went on with the priesthood and things that people believe about Christ and about the high priest and about what took unfolded in his time. And so basically we're going to look at what the scholars have to say and then how do you answer what those scholars have to say. I think it'll be interesting and to see, well, how do you answer that? And basically, as you look at scholars that look at Christ in the Scriptures, they believe it's a totally botched mess. And they don't believe that they're reflecting reality at all. So they believed it was fake news. So anyway, we would not see it that way. But you got to understand what's going on there and how it all fits together. And they're not able to see how it fits together. They have certain ideas and prejudices, and I think you'll see them as we look at some of those things. So anyway, that's for the future. So this individual that we're looking at here, his name is Aristobulus. Aristobulus, and Herod the Great made this man high priest, but Aristobulus was made high priest, and he was very popular with the people. So he did his job well. The people liked him, held him in high esteem. But when he became popular, how did Herod take it, do you think? Herod, being the paranoid, he did not like that at all. So he had a banquet for Aristobulus, and then Aristobulus was the guest of honor. And so at the banquet, he drowned Aristobulus. So if Herod invited you to the party, it may be time for you to leave town, you know, if you were living in that time. And this is only one thing that Herod did. He also had several wives, the favorite of which was a woman by the name of Mariamne or Miriam. And he also was insanely jealous of her. And on one of his journeys, he left orders that if he didn't return alive, that she was to be put to death. So probably be unwise to marry Herod as well. So in other words, if he couldn't have her, then nobody else could. And he was quite the person. She accused him of murdering her grandfather, and so he had her executed. So Herod killed his sons, he killed his wives, he was going to kill a vast number of people who had served him as his life was coming to an end. And he was going to do that because he figured, well, if I kill all these people, they're going to mourn all these people's death. And nobody's going to mourn my death. So I'm going to ensure there's mourning. Now, you may detect that maybe there's some mental instability here, but he had some serious problems. But one of the true things that he did was he built some magnificent structures, and we'll look at a few of those. And this is the primary structure that he completed, which was the temple. Not only did he have the temple, but he created an entire place there. You got the temple, and you've got the courts, and it was truly a magnificent structure. And it was not completed until after the death of Jesus Christ. But it was truly a magnificent structure, one of the seven wonders of the world. In fact, the platform on which they built the temple was about the size of 30 football fields. So that's a pretty large place. You know, when you look at a model, you really can't tell. But it was a very significant place and quite imposing. He transformed the city of Jerusalem into a world-class city. Jerusalem was kind of a small place, but he rebuilt the temple and really rebuilt much of Rome, and it was a very impressive place. Now, all of this is about him, of course, but he did build some amazing things. He built, in Jerusalem itself, he built a magnificent palace. It was huge. It was an amazing place. that he built, which you can see from this model. He built on the ocean a place called Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea, from scratch. He pioneered the use of hydraulic concrete that would set underwater, and used it to build a huge breakwater and port completely from scratch. So they accomplished some amazing things, and he established a port there that would serve Judea. Caesarea Maritima became a great city. You can see here that they had a theater, and you had a hippodrome, which was here for horse races. So they it was amazing what he was able to accomplish. Also, he built a fabulous palace. This is the remnants of which we find here by the ocean. And then he rebuilt Samaria. Samaria, which had been destroyed during the time of Israel, he rebuilt a city there, a very impressive Roman city, and in the hills of Samaria. He built another great palace at Jericho, which was his winter palace. So he's doing a lot of building. And then he built, we're all familiar with Masada. Masada was a great fortress that he built, and palace out in the desert near the Dead Sea. It was equipped with a huge storehouse, and it was said to contain enough food for 10,000 men for 10 years. So it was quite an interesting and formidable place. Here you can see, in the next picture, you can see that it was a three-level palace, and there were drops from the main area of about 1,000 feet. So it was quite impressive, and it was the place where after the Bar Kokhba revolt, they held up and fought against the Romans, and eventually the Romans got them, but it was a formidable place for them to take. Now, you see this here was the a fortress and palace complex called the Herodium. You can see the thing that looks like a mountain back there, and you've got a palace here. And the Herodium was essentially a man-made mountain. And this is an artist's depiction of it. And this is where Herod's tomb was placed, and they just found it in the last few years. Now, as you look at the area where Christ and the apostles operated, as you think about Herod, he built all these different palaces and fortresses all around the area. And Herod was quite an effective builder and accomplished a lot in his time. After Herod's death, he was replaced by a man called Archelaus. And Archelaus primarily ruled in this area here, the area of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. But he only ruled from 3 to 6 B.C., 6 A.D. He didn't rule all that long because he offended the people, and they got rid of him. And so he was replaced by another ruler there. And as you think about Archelaus, he's mentioned in Matthew chapter 2, verse 22, where it says, "But when he, Joseph, heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there." So he was a Herod. He was a threat. "And being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside into the region of Galilee." So that's how Joseph and his family came to dwell in the area of Galilee, because Archelaus was a threat. He was a threat. He was a Herod, and maybe we need to stay away from him. The next ruler was a man by the name of Philip the Tetrarch, and he ruled for quite a long time. And he ruled in this area here, and some across the Sea of Galilee. He was not a cruel leader. He had a bit more respect than some of the others, who indeed were very cruel. He built the city of Caesarea Philippi, and that is mentioned in the Gospels. And being a humble man, like so many other rulers of the time, he named the city after himself. Herod Antipas, we're all familiar with, you've heard the name Herod Antipas, and he was responsible for the area of across the Jordan. So Herod Antipas ruled in the Decapolis. He was over on this side of the Jordan. That's where he ruled. And we find Herod Antipas mentioned in Luke chapter 13, verse 32, where it says, "Go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected." And Jesus calls him a fox. Go tell that fox, because he was a rather cunning individual. Now, Herod Antipas was not well respected, especially by the Jews. And one thing that he did was to build the city of Tiberias. The city of Tiberias was built along the edge of the Sea of Galilee, on top of a graveyard, which believing Jews saw as making the city unclean. As a Jew, you wouldn't enter into that city because of the dead there. As a result of that, the only way he could get anybody to move into the town that he had built was to put in non-Jews, because, as I said, the Jews wouldn't live there. And Tiberias is only a few miles from Capernaum, and it was the biggest city in the area, but not once do the Gospels mention Jesus ever going to Tiberias. Didn't go there. And the Sea of Galilee is also known as the Sea of Tiberias. That's another name for it. So, but there was another reason too, and that's because Herod Antipas is the man who killed who? Which of the prominent men in the Bible in Christ's time did Herod Antipas kill? John the Baptist. He's the one that beheaded John the Baptist. And so John the Baptist was brought to Tiberias, and there he was executed. So Herod is also the one who is mentioned in Luke 23, and he's the one that Pilate became friends with in Christ's time. I remember Christ was sent to Herod, and Herod interrogated him and could find nothing to condemn him on, and he was sent back to Pilate, and they became fast friends at that particular time. Now let's talk about the religious background of the Gospels. The religious background. So religion was a big deal in Judea. And in Judea, as far as religion is concerned, you had three major religious groups: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. They were all religious groups. And then you had two other groups, the Zealots and the Herodians. They were both political groups. They were largely, the Zealots and Herodians were largely secular, and they were not religious like the Pharisees. The main religious body, they were the Pharisees. And they're the group that we're probably most familiar with. They were the largest and most influential during Christ's time. Now, where do we get the word Pharisee from? Does anybody know that? Well, it came from the Hebrew word parash. Parash, which means to separate. You saw, if you look at the Pharisees, they sought to be separate from this and that and the other thing. And that's what they sought to do, was to become separate from Gentiles and separate from this and that. And they sought to live that kind of life. And there is a point where that is godly and biblical. And there's a point where it goes too far. And we can see as we look at the Pharisees that they did go too far. The Pharisees began to have influence about 135 BC. So they were well established by the time Christ came on the scene and began his ministry. And they had been around for more than 100 years, and their approach to the law was very technical and detailed. Remember, they're condemning Christ's apostles for pulling some of the grains of that were available at that time, the barley harvest. And they didn't want and they sought to separate themselves and put a hedge around the law. You had the law, but the law wasn't good enough. So they came up with other rules and guidelines that they established. Also, they considered the oral law to be just as binding as the written law. And that's still the case today. The oral law was basically their own tradition. For the most part, it is their own tradition. Remember in Matthew chapter 23, Christ condemned them because they were so worried about counting out little seeds and had completely missed the weightier matters of the law, judgment, faith, and the third element there. They missed that, and Christ condemned them for it. The other group, notable group, some notable things about our notable Pharisees. Can anybody think of any Pharisees that are prominent in the Gospels? What's that? Caiaphas, yes. Paul, yes. Anybody else? So Caiaphas, yes, he was a Pharisee. Caiaphas wasn't a Pharisee. Caiaphas was a priest. He was a high priest, so he's a Sadducee. But Paul was a Pharisee. Anybody else that you can remember? Who? Nicodemus, right? Nicodemus. We meet him in John chapter 5. And my wife's looking around, so I can't hear. So I'm just letting you know. My hearing is impaired. And so don't say it quietly. Say it a little bit louder. I can maybe hear it. Or say it loud enough for my wife to see it, and then she'll let me know what you said. So anyway, you had Nicodemus. Anybody else? We had Paul. You also had Joseph of Arimathea, who was a Pharisee, and the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul was the Pharisee of the Pharisees. And so we have those men. And we also have this group. But when Paul... And they had certain beliefs. And this illustrates what those beliefs were in Acts chapter 23, verse 6. It says, "But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged.'" And what happened after he said that? What? The big quarrel is a huge conflict, because did the Sadducees believe in the resurrection? They did not. So the Sadducees did not believe in that. That's something that the Pharisees believed in, the resurrection. Paul recognized that and exploited it. So when you think about the Pharisees, anybody know where this is? It's here in Houston? No, it's the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and you have this is a place of pilgrimage for the Jews. And it's interesting, if you go there and you're getting close to sunset, you have to stop taking pictures 20 minutes before the Sabbath, before sundown. So you got to quit 20 minutes ahead. So that's you can't continue taking pictures after that. Does anybody know why you have to stop taking pictures? The Pharisaical rule. The reason you have to stop is because you are, in taking pictures, you are kindling a fire on the Sabbath. Now, I want you to go home and see if you can kindle a fire with your camera. So if anybody's able to get that done, it'll be quite an innovation. And because the electrical current that is, flows from the battery and allows the picture to be taken, it's considered to be kindling a fire on the Sabbath. And so they're quite meticulous in stopping you from taking pictures about that time. The next group of people that was common in Christ's time were the Sadducees. And according to tradition, they derived their name from, do you know who they derived their name from? It was a famous priest. Well, Zadok. So they were Zadokis, or Sadducees, as we would say it. And Zadok was the high priest during the time of David and Solomon. And they derived their name from those from that time. They were more of the priestly group, and they believed. So did the Sadducees accept the whole Old Testament? So what portion of the Bible do you think they accepted? They accepted only the five books of Moses. They didn't accept any of the other books. And they rejected the idea of angels and spirits. They rejected the resurrection. And because of their beliefs, they were more open to Greek ideas than the Pharisees. So they easily aligned with the Greeks or the Romans, whoever was in power. And they tended to be opportunists who changed with the wind. So whichever the way the wind was blowing, they were quick to figure it out and follow it. Yes?
Does that imply that Zadok, in the time of Solomon, did not believe in these things also?
To me, Zadok was faithful. They took the name from him, but I'm not sure that he had the same philosophy that they did. I think their philosophy developed over time. Zadok was a faithful servant and dedicated to keeping God's laws and being a faithful high priest. I mean, he's held in high esteem, and I think if he was had compromised, he wouldn't be seen by God the way that he was. He was a faithful man. So just because they took his name doesn't mean he believed the same way they did. I would imagine if he was when he's resurrecting, he said, "What went wrong with you guys? You guys just missed the whole boat with that." As far as the Sadducees are concerned, we see here the priest, and this is the fall of the city of Jerusalem. We don't hear much about them after the destruction of Jerusalem. Why don't we hear much about them? Okay. I can hear noise, but I'm not sure what's being said.
No temple.
There was no temple, right. There's no priestly work going on. There is no temple. They have no reason to exist. So with the destruction of the temple, that's it for them. And now you do have individuals around. You know, you've probably met some people named Cohen, and that very name means priest. So they still exist, but they're not doing priestly work at this time. I think there are people that are named Cohen who are desirous of getting it started again, but to date that's not happened. So the last group that we're going to talk about are the Essenes. This here is out in the desert. They lived out in the desert. They did not marry. And basically the only reason you added more of them is because people joined up. They weren't producing children. You can already see that that's not the way God ordained things from what we talked about today. But they lived out in the desert in a place called, one of the places was called Qumran, and you have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they stored these scrolls in these caves. They were found, I know the first group was found by a shepherd boy, and they've become quite famous. They were an ascetic brotherhood, as best we can tell, and they rejected the priesthood in Jerusalem as being corrupt, and which it was, and they moved out into the desert around the Dead Sea in order to live a separate life. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls are associated with them, and so we have those, and the scrolls are actually available, which they weren't for a long time, and give us certain indications about the early New Testament period. They were quite unbalanced, and some people have said that that John the Baptist was a part of that sect. Was he? I don't think so, but He did live in the desert, and he did take on the role like an Elijah, but he was not part of that sect. Now, the last group we want to talk about, that's the Dead Sea Scrolls, are the Zealots. The Zealots were a political group, and what was their goal? To overthrow the Romans. That was their goal. That was their purpose. They were political. And they were very much involved in the uprising in 70 AD. And basically they egged things on to the point where it got out of hand and the Romans wiped them out in 70 AD. They stirred up a lot of trouble and there was no good that came from it. So where do we see the Zealots mentioned in the New Testament, any place in the Gospels? Do we see the Zealots mentioned? Yes.
Simon the Zealot.
You had Simon the Zealot in Luke 6:15. You have Simon called the Zealot. So this man who was zealous for overthrowing the Romans was one of Christ's disciples, one who became an apostle. And so he became one of the 12. And you go on, and it says in Acts chapter 1, verse 13, it says, "And when they had entered, they went up into the upper room where they were staying, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, Philip, and Thomas, Bartholomew, and Matthew, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, the son of Zealot, Simon the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James." Now, do you think there might have been any conflict between any of Christ's disciples? Simon is a zealot. Do you think there was anybody that Simon, as a zealot, might have had some conflict? Yeah, the tax collector. You're a collaborator with those Romans. It doesn't tell us that that happened, but that certainly could have. And because they just had a completely different view of things. So you had Matthew, who was the tax collector. And the Zealots were known for carrying daggers and carrying out assassinations. And we have a couple of Barabbas was a zealot. We have a couple of individuals on either side of Christ that suffered execution as a result of being a part of that sect. So that hopefully gives you some background of the Gospels. And next time we're going to talk about something that is also part of the background. But when you look at the Gospels, they begin with genealogies. A couple of them begin with genealogies. The question is, how many of you read through the genealogy and look at every name? Some of you do. Most people are like, okay, I can speed read through this and move on to another section. But why did they go through the details of writing out those genealogies? We'll look at that next time. Thank you for your attention. Please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath day and a good week ahead. And we'll see you next week.